My general view is that no matter what the problem, the answer is in your community and the people you surround yourselves with.
You're listening to Hawk Talk, a podcast all about the origin stories of the most interesting people in the world. Today, you know our guests as famous athletes, authors, and entrepreneurs, but there's so much more to the story. Let's get into today's interview with your host, Eric Huberman.
All right, you're listening to Hawk Talk. I'm here today with John Deavy. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's a rainy day. It's miserable outside, but I have a five-month-old that giggles a lot. So like the house could not be more full of joy right now.
Yeah. It's one of those things that until you hear your own baby giggle, like there is no, you don't know what happiness is.
It's just like, that. Yeah. It's just so funny. And how excited I am for calls to end early so that I could go run into the room to like get 2 minutes.
Yeah. I had the same. I mean, we've got ours turns 14 months today and spent the morning hanging out with her, and it was just like, God, this is the best. Like, there's just, your day's good. It doesn't matter what you're going into. It's like, I have this. Who cares? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So, speaking of babies, I assume, you know, taking it way back when you were born, I assume you decided the day you were born to go around the hospital and gather all the most interesting babies in the hospital in the delivery room. And that's how this all kicked off, right? You were immediately like, I'm going to be the host. I'm going to, you know, bring people together. And from day one, that's who you were, right?
Absolutely. And if by most popular able to gather people, you mean I was so geeky, nobody wanted to be my friend.
So to take it back, where were you born, by the way?
I was born in Tel Aviv while my parents were on vacation because my parents were wildly irresponsible and traveled during the end of the third trimester and went on a vacation to Israel, where they've spent many vacations, mind you. So it was like a consistent thing. But they're like, screw it. We have 3 other kids at this point. If something goes wrong with this one, whatever.
We're 3 for 3. If we're 3 for 4.
Like, yeah, it's like, whatever. My father was 1 of 12. Like, you know, it's a different game completely.
Numbers game at that point.
Yeah. So,
okay, got it. And so you're born in Tel Aviv. Does that actually mean you have Israeli citizenship and the U.S.?
Like, I'm a thrice citizen. I don't know. Triple citizen. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah.
I'm Israeli, American, and Portuguese.
Got it. Which is that on your own or one of your parents?
On my own. Yeah, it's we don't know how long this is going to last, but there's this law that the Portuguese put in place that if you could prove that your family was displaced in 1492 because of anti-Semitism, you can apply for Portuguese reinstatement, and I did.
Nice. Got it. And so, all right, so you're born in Tel Aviv. I assume you came back the moment your mom could fly again. Like, how quickly?
Yeah, it was like 3 weeks later. I was in New York. I don't even know if I can be president.
Yeah, actually, I don't know either. I don't know how that works.
Because I'm born an American citizen abroad, and you have to be born on like U.S. soil, or I don't even know what. Anyway,
that would be pretty interesting. Do you have aspirations to run for president?
Worst job in America. It's
seriously. And so you're born and raised in New York, or you're born in Tel Aviv, but you're really raised in New York. Tell me about your upbringing. Like, it sounds like your parents were adventurous.
Yeah, my father's a painter and sculptor. Kind of wild dude. I mean, he is like the quintessential big personality artist. His works were in like a lot of major places and private collections and all that. And he was just such an odd dude, right? So I should explain. I look really white, but my father's side is Yemenite. So my grandfather was like very, very dark, more traditionally ethnic features. My grandmother's either North African or Turkish. We're not really sure because there wasn't good record keeping. And so my dad does not look like everybody else, at least not on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So I'd get made fun of a lot. And he'd have this afro and paint-covered overalls because he's an artist. And he would do this thing where he'd bark and it would sound exactly like a dog. And people would think that there'd be a dog present. So he'd go to like a really nice restaurant. And my dad would look around and then he'd start barking. And the waiters would be like, sir, you can't have your pet here. This is unacceptable. This is a nice restaurant. My father would be like, what are you talking about? Like, all the people who were with him would be trained to like look under the chairs and stuff to see if there was to pretend to look for a dog. Like, it was just ridiculous. My mom loved that stuff and like very much encouraged my dad. When we'd be in public and she'd hear a dog barking, she'd think my dad was nearby. Like, that's it was... We were 4 kids, so it was like insanity constantly. There were people over at our house on any given day. You wouldn't know who or what to expect. It could be literally some French vagabond that he met on a trip that he's like, oh, you can come and stay with us for a week. Or it would be like, you get these occasional like famous actors or art collectors that would swing by to pick up a painting they bought, and you'd be like, was that? No, that can't be. Okay, moving on. So that was my childhood. It was very odd, but fortunately a very, like, very loving environment. My parents
and
were...
did your mom work as well, or was she?
Yeah. She supported my dad in the early days as a musician teaching at different music institutes and stuff like that.
Awesome. What did you just generally, or what kind of music?
Classical style. But yeah, it was, you know, she's like a classically trained pianist and conductor and all that. So
very cool. And so did you grow up to, like, as a young kid, what was the, this is what I want to be when I grow up. And I think to take a quick step, I think
That
a big portion of my podcast has been people you have introduced me to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We'll get into it. But your ability to curate people that are all the things everyone else wants to be when they grow up, I think is probably a way of putting what you've pulled together. And, you know, from astronauts to CIA operatives to just top people in all the fields. The last time I think it was a Top Gun pilot that spoke, like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's great. Hazard Lee.
Yeah.
He's a Wall Street Journal bestseller. Yeah. Super smart dude.
So on your side, like, what was it when you were a kid? What did you want to be when you grew up?
I want to be like RoboCop or, you know, the leader of the Autobots. I was like a little kid, right?
Yeah. No, but that'd be
in reality, like, I initially thought like architect and things like that. And I wanted to have more impact, but it took me a really long time to kind of find my groove. I studied computer science, math at and economics at NYU. I have two of those degrees.
Hold on that. Computer science, math, and economics. What were you thinking through with that combination? Like, what was the, like...
I graduated in 2002. I thought I'd go work at, like, a big tech company because it was, like, you know, when I went into school, like, it was, you know, dot-com era. Everybody was building these huge teams, getting massive valuations. And then the bubble burst while I was in school, right, around 2001. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. Yeah. And I should point out, I'm dyslexic. And it really shaped my personality in the sense that I'm not a good reader. I'm not very, like, I never thought I'd be able to function in the corporate environment because it often seemed that you have to be able to, like, be traditionally book functional. And that was not me. I should also point out that when I was in grade school, I was so geeky and into computers, I'm really unpopular. Like, one day in eighth grade, the small class, it was like 16 of us, the teacher, I grew up in the city, so it's like, you know, you go to like one of these private schools in the city, Hebrew day schools, the classes weren't huge back then. And the teacher comes in and she says, hey, we're going to reassign the seating chart. Each of you can secretly submit two people you want to sit with and two people you don't want to sit with. And that day I found out two things. There was, first of all, one kid like nobody wanted to sit with, like literally nobody. And the second thing I discovered was that kid was me. And so I was totally heartbroken, but I really wanted to understand what made the popular kid popular and what made me the outcast.
Yeah.
And so I think it's driven a lot of my desire to bring people together is that I felt kind of lonely as a kid.
Your experience, was it because just social dynamics in eighth grade and kids are mean and you like things that were considered nerdy and so they didn't want to be with you? Or did you think now that you've like really reflected on this, your life, and it's really seems to have led to becoming the opposite. What do you think it was?
I think that when you have 16 kids, there isn't necessarily like from different backgrounds, then there, it's not a homogenous group. There isn't a lot of common ground, you know? And so even when you're popular, it's 16 kids. Like, how popular can you be?
I don't know if you know, I had the same thing. I had 11 kids in my graduating class. Like, I had anywhere between 8 and 16 kids all through school.
Yeah. And so it didn't even allow for large cliques of any.
Right.
Right. They were like the three athletic kids. And then, and they were kind of the cool kids because the girls in the grade below wanted to date them to some degree. So I think the issue is that maybe if I was in a bigger school, I would have had more sense of belonging and more finding my people. So I think that that's definitely part of it. And I was never like athletically inclined. I wasn't good at basketball or any of the other sports the kids played.
Got it. And so that sort of, you said you wanted to start learning about that. Like, I mean, obviously that hurts as a kid, But how did that parlay when you were going into school? Like when you were in middle school, high school, obviously you weren't, I think you didn't want to be an Autobot anymore. Maybe you were still.
I very much wanted to be human.
In high school, what were you thinking through?
In high school, I went deep into the sciences. Like I even gave up my lunch period just to take more science classes. I took chemistry and physics and design technology and physiology, literally any science that I could get my hands on. I gave up my phys ed period to take more classes and then did phys ed after school. Like anything I could get my hands on to really understand how things work was what I got obsessed with. And then later in life,
to understand the world more, or what was it about all these sciences?
I think that there seemed to be like this definitive angle of knowing that, you know, in physics, if I drop a ball, we know where it's going to end up. We know how to calculate it. We know in the design technology classes we took, we would engineer things. And we knew that, like, if you run this electricity through this, there was a definitive outcome. It's not a theoretical, it's not up to interpretation. This, you do X, Y is the result. And that was really kind of exciting to me, that there could be that much control over something and the outcome.
Got it. And so that makes sense then, going into college, computer science, math, like you liked sciences. And
oh yeah. But you know, it's one of these funny things, like you could be the best in your school at math in high school, and then you go to a college and you're like barely middle of the pack, and there's some 16-year-old kid who's, you know, doing rings around you, like doing math in their head that you would take a week to do. It's just not like the same game anymore.
Where'd you
know? I went to NYU.
Cool. And so I wanted to stay in New York too. It seems like you had a thing for New York.
I love New York, but I'll be honest, it was the most prestigious school I managed to get into. So I just went there. Like when you're 18, you're like, what did I know about the world?
It's 100%. I went back. I mean, I went to University of Arizona, and it was because it seemed close enough, far enough, had a good enough rating as a business school. And then I went to I checked it out when I was a senior in high school, and I went to a pajama party and went, I'm going to go here.
Yeah, so that's there's this behavioral bias called the misattribution of arousal. And the way it works is, or the famous study is, men were asked to go across one of two bridges, either a standard bridge or a high ropes bridge, right? So like you cross the Brooklyn Bridge, nothing scary about it. You cross a high ropes bridge, it's exciting and scary. Now there's a woman on the far side, and she says, thank you for participating in the study. Here's my phone number. If you have any questions or you need anything, please feel free to reach out. Apparently a disproportionate number of men who crossed the high ropes bridge called her and asked her out. And the reason is that when you confuse the emotional state that your body is feeling for the context that you're in, you cannot separate the two. And so if you see Arizona as the pajama party, you go to this one thing at Arizona that was this pajama party, and you're like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever been to. Then you think that that's what every day is like. And of course it's not. It's just a mistake.
Here's what it was, but we can get into it.
Really? I went to the wrong school.
Yeah, no, it's everything the reputation precedes itself. It's a good time. But yeah, anyways, getting back into the meat of this. So you get out of college. Did you go into, obviously the dot-com bust happens while you're in school. What'd you do coming out? Did you end up getting?
I had some failed startups.
So you tried to do your own thing.
Yeah. And I was not very good at it. And I was good enough that I could pay my bills, but not anything else. Right.
I mean, most people can say that. So that's great.
Oh, and I forgot to mention though, in college, I was the number one student at Cutco Cutlery Corporation. So if you like buying knives, you're in luck because I was able to sell you some.
By the way, so was I.
Were you really?
Yeah, in 2000. That's
the best sales training I ever got.
It's incredible. That was 2006 for me.
Mm-hmm. 2000, 2001. Yeah.
Wow. And yeah, my business partner at Hawk ran the Southwest for Cutco while I was a salesperson. We met at the time, but don't remember it. We just know we met because of circumstances. And yeah, a lot of Cutco people around.
Yeah, I've sold hundreds of thousands of dollars in knives.
It's nice. That'll pay some bills too. Like you actually make great money.
Oh yeah. I made, I think, 50 or 60 grand my junior or senior year of college. And this was 2001. So you've got to think that's like probably 100 grand now.
while working part time and hanging out. And yeah, it's great. No, it's a really good gig. So, all right. So you got the, you were a knife salesman. You were on the cutting edge and then you get into
well done.
Yeah. Got to do all the puns. Fast forward. So what did you like, what did you start gravitating towards? If you had these, and what was the startups actually? Let's go into that. What did you try?
I'll be honest. They're not that interesting. They were in education, but when that all kind of came apart, I was hired by Rodale, the company that owns Men's Health Magazine, Women's Health, or used to, now it belongs to Hearst, to be their director of digital strategy for their in-house agency. And that's when I really started getting heavily into applied sciences. So they have this really cool thing, an entire PhD library team that I could ask for any topic and they would pull the latest research for me on it.
Wow.
And so we would have projects and I'd say, hey, I need you to pull research on weight loss and technology. And they would do all this research and then hand me a pile of studies. And then I would take those studies and turn them into strategies. So like, oh, would it make more sense to have an avatar that talks to you about your exercise than just text messages because avatars are treated better than random, you know, whatever it was. And so we'd be able to come up with these strategies that nobody else would even think of that were science backed. And that's when I said, oh, wow, I'm actually really good at this. Maybe I could do this professionally. At the same time, I'd launched a little before that, I'd launched the dinners.
Yeah. And so talk about the dinners, but what and why were the dinners?
why were the dinners? I wanted people to cook for me.
Burritos.
The background is there's this crazy study called, actually it's by these two guys, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler. They were curious, early 2000s, is obesity spread from person to person like a cold, or is it a percentage of the population like Alzheimer's? And what they found was absolutely startling. If you have a friend who's obese, your chances of obesity increases by 45%.
Wow.
Your friends who do not know them have a 20% increased chance, and their friends have a 5% increased chance.
And now is the causation because you're around those people, or is it actually the opposite, where it's like those people have a higher chance because they're in the same circumstance, whether it's those...
So you know, it's both, right? So for example, if we hang out, I might say, hey, let's take a walk.
Yeah.
And if somebody who isn't as physically active says, let's hang out, you might go to a meal, see a movie and eat a tub of popcorn. So there's causal characteristics. There is also homophily, meaning like birds of a feather flock together, or I guess hawks of a feather flock, I don't know, whatever,
yeah.
Right? And that means that you might have friends from the gym. You might have friends from, you know, the baseball team. And so they would have more consistent behavior. But this kind of stuff is true for happiness, marriage and divorce rates, smoking habits, voting habits. So if you start hanging out with people who are more politically inclined in an alternate direction, you might begin to notice that you're more open-minded to certain perspectives.
Yep. Interesting. And so where did you come across a study and decide you wanted to have dinner with cool people? Is that what happened?
What I said was, well, maybe then instead of beating myself up for hitting snooze every morning when I wanted to go to the gym, if instead I was just friends with a bunch of athletes, then maybe I would work out. It would just be a natural part of my life rather than something I had to force myself and willpower myself and discipline myself into doing.
Yeah.
And I realized maybe every aspect of my life is like that. Maybe if I hung out with people who are very wealthy, I could learn how to become wealthy. Maybe if, you know, and whatever the thing was. And so I said, okay, then how do I meet the people I admire most and the people I respect the most? I spent about a year modeling their behavior. And then from that, I developed a secret dining experience. 12 people are invited. They're not allowed to talk about what they do or give their last name. They cook dinner together. And when they sit down to eat, they get to guess what everybody does. They find out that it's a 8-time Olympian, an astronaut, a Nobel laureate, a CEO, a Grammy Award winner, so on and so forth. And so I've hosted 325 dinners that are completely free to all the attendees across 11 cities in 4 countries.
And which is crazy and impressive. And how did you originally get those people to attend? How did you get
the first group wasn't that impressive. Like you wouldn't, you'd be like, oh, those are nice people. I enjoyed hanging out with them. But it was a byproduct of a few things. One is just being relentless, right? I would, once I came up with a topic, it took, or the concept, it took months to do the second one and the third one, right? To collect people, organize it. It takes a long time till systems are put in place. So the first dinner was like nice people. They're great.
What was the, right? The pitch? Just come to dinner. I'm going to do something cool. Like what was the original?
Yeah, because it was people I knew.
Okay.
And then the next dinner was still people I knew. I tried to partner with other people to invite some of them, and that never actually worked out because nobody was as dedicated to it as I was.
Yeah.
And so we'd pick different recipes, make a mess in my house. I also had no money. And when I say no money, I mean, I was heavily in debt, not just from college, but credit card debt. And I put all this food and stuff on my credit card just because I thought, hey, this is an important way to meet people. And I end up hosting probably my second dinner or something like that. And the person said, when the guest said, hey, you should come to this event I'm going to on whatever this weekend. And when I did, it was a bunch of the Daily Show writers. And so they had all Emmys. And so I started inviting them. And then I'd say, oh, you know, it's really impressive people. We have people from the who are Emmy Award winners coming, people who are, you know. And yep. So then it became this thing where like award winners go. And I just kept doing it. And then I realized, wait, I could just hire virtual assistants to track down anybody who's won any award. So I went and I picked every list of award winners, send it to a research team. They tracked down the emails and then we just started cold emailing. And then literally like Nobel laureates would show up. Like it was crazy. Yeah. And I was relentless.
I'm curious, like what was the message to a Nobel laureate? That guy, it was a debt. We have Emmy Award winners, Academy Award winners, blah, 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 coming.
Yeah.
And you, have you?
Yeah, it felt like it's free. Thing. I have nothing to pitch you. There's no business angle. Like I have nothing to sell you. This is also off the record. So I'm not trying to get famous by using your name or anything like that. And it's an interesting group of people. It's really low risk and we'd love to have you. And then the New York Times came to me and said, hey, can we do a story about this? And I said, I appreciate it, but I'm not interested. And they're like, we're the New York Times. And I was like, okay, fine.
Yeah. And so how did that happen? How did they come wind of it? Who told the New York, do you know how that?
So the strategy was always, I knew at some point I would have something to share with the world. I just didn't know when. But every dinner I ran, I'd make sure to invite journalists. And they had to know and follow the rules that this was off the record, no stories. One of them was a contributor for Forbes and said, hey, John, I'd like to do a little thing. Is that okay? Can you send me some photos? Asked permission from all the people who attended the dinner. They were fine with it. And what ended up happening was there was a popular show on air at the time called The Wire. One of the actors from that show was there. And so there are all these photos of him and a bunch of other kind of fancy folk in this Forbes article that's probably still online somewhere.
Cool. Got it.
Like the next year, the Times said, hey, you've never had like a news story about it. I'm like, we're fine with this. We're good. I want to stay under the radar. And it was the wife of Jason Pfeiffer, who you might know, he's the editor-in-chief now of Entrepreneur Magazine. She said, hey, I'm a freelance writer. I'd love to do something about this. And I said, okay, sure. And I want you to understand, I was so naive about what this meant. Like I literally had no clue. I was so,
well,
had no
honest,
money.
If you haven't come from press, a contributor article in Forbes does not get you any notoriety. Like, it's cool, but like,
yeah,
you
it's
don't
cool.
Get
that actually, it went viral. That one went kind of viral. It was seen by tens of thousands of people. Like the normal contributor articles are like 300.
Right. Your phone wasn't ringing off the hook every day for the next year.
No.
And the dinner, like that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm guessing New York Times, a little different.
Yeah. So to this day, people still reference that. Like people I meet are like, oh, I saw that in the Times years ago. I always wondered how to get invited. So what ends up happening is I'm so naive. Like it didn't even occur to me that this is important. So like we were still drinking out of solo cups as if it's like some college party, and the New York Times sent a photographer and they're like, what photos are we even going to use? Because this all looks ridiculous. And at that dinner, we had like Stacey London from What Not to Wear and Princess Kalia Aga Khan, and the editor-in-chief of Men's Health was there, and a bunch of other people, Fern Malice, who created Fashion Week and all that. that was like an impressive group. And we then, after that story, my life just changed because I had like real street credibility as like a New Yorker. And the funniest thing that came out of it by far, and I cannot emphasize how little positive impact it had on me. I was selected for every bachelor list that existed, kind of. I was on Elle Magazine's list of bachelors and Gotham Magazine and you know, this list and that list.
And what was the title? Was it like the guy that knows everybody or the guy that hosts everybody?
Like, yeah, it makes each, it will serve you crappy food or something. I don't even know. Right. But like, it's so funny. You think that getting on those lists, you're going to be like dating the who's who. Nobody cares at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's just.
Well, it's probably intimidating, to be honest. Like, unless you're going to go out and use it, which then you're kind of douchey.
Oh, like, yeah. I could not.
Like a bunch of girls are going to read that list and like do what you did with the Nobel Laureate list and hire they're not going to hire a virtual assistant and start
to track down dudes to date.
Let's hit up all these people on the list and invite them to dinner.
Yeah. I did get a lot of random friend requests from people who probably didn't speak much English. That was.
Got it. Then, by the way, little side note, it might've been fun to do a dinner with that list.
Like the most. That's so funny. That is so, that's so clever. Maybe I should track down like the 2013 class of most eligible bachelors and see what they're up to.
100%. You're the guy that knows how to get them to dinner. It'd be hilarious. So, okay. Yeah. New episode of The Bachelor, by the way. All right. So you build these dinners, and career wise, were you still working at Rodal or what were you doing?
But at a certain point they shut down and shuttered the division. So I felt very ashamed that I lost my job and then needed to figure out what to do with myself. What ended up happening was that companies kept coming to me and saying, can we sponsor the dinner? And I would say no, because I don't want any confusion about why I'm building a relationship with these people. I want to have real relationships. But I'd say, hey, I can help you design the way that you interact with your customers. And so I launched kind of more of an experiential education and training agency. I do some public speaking, and it took me a bit of time to get it off the ground. And it was fine. And, you know, my income rose and all that kind of stuff, and the company was doing solid. But when the pandemic came, because we were so focused on how to engage customers in person, I lost 73% of my business overnight.
Oh, wow.
And so I thought I was done for. And at that point, I was already doing research. I'd done with my lab partner, probably the largest study in history on dating, which was super funny. So did we ever talk about this?
No.
We used Hinge's data because I was on their advisory board. So they let us, I didn't have any direct access. I didn't see any of the profiles or anything. We would just ask, hey, can you pull this information?
Yeah.
And we asked questions like, what actually causes somebody to date? And we found if you have the same initials, you're 11.3% more likely to date.
I love that because you know my wife's initials.
Before marriage or after?
Well, after. It's even easier. But you know my wife's, I don't know if you know my wife's name.
Eric. I don't. Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so fun. Oh, that's so fun. So it turns out there's something called implicit egotism. Anything that reminds us of ourselves is more attractive or appealing.
I joke all the time that the reason we're married is straight narcissism on both sides. So,
That's probably, you
there's
probably
a little bit of accuracy. Like
a 20 or 30% increased chance of dating because your names are just straight out. But we also found that's true for everything from like what type of phone you use to which NCAA conference your school was in when you were in college. And basically we're attracted to things that are familiar. It's this mere exposure effect. It's also why, you remember Coca-Cola released all those bottles with people's names on them?
Yeah.
Because the familiarity made it more appealing to buy.
Yeah.
I'd started doing research. We also did the largest study on coupon use. We found weird things like on rainy days, people use less coupons or, you know, there's something called the delusion of discount, which is a phrase we coined, which is that if you get a $100 coupon, or let me change these numbers. Hotel rooms, $100. You get a $20 coupon from a website. What is your total bill, not including taxes and everything?
80.
Correct, $120. Because when you get $20 off, you see it as found money, and now you justify it to upgrade.
Got it.
And so we called it the delusion of discount because you're delusional if you actually think that them giving you a coupon will actually discount anything for you.
Got it. So meaning they end up raising the room rate, but giving you a coupon?
No. Meaning that you feel comfortable spending more to upgrade because you get a discount on the upgrade.
Got it. So more people upgraded. They ended up averaging 120 instead of 8. Yeah. Should have maybe. Got it.
But whatever those numbers, right? It's like if I said, hey, you know, you could, your normal flight price is $100. First class should be 1,000, but I'm going to give you a $200 discount. A lot more people will end up buying the first class ticket.
Yeah, makes sense. My wife's habits are there. Down the fairway. They're on sale is a great line.
Yes, exactly. The more you spend, the more you save.
Yeah, so. Exactly. 100%. No, that makes sense. Got it. And so you were doing these studies. And who are you doing them for? Like, how are you monetizing?
I'm mostly corporations. So like one was with RetailMeNot because they have the largest couponing site in the world. That other one we did with Hinge. There were some articles about it. The study did pretty well from a reception standpoint. We also found something really funny. Like we thought introverts would date introverts and extroverts would date extroverts. But they don't, because introverts and introverts never talk to each other.
Yeah.
You kind of just need at least one extrovert to make it function. Yeah. Is your wife extroverted or?
It's funny. I would consider her extroverted compared to anyone but me. So like there's situations where she's the more social one, but I'm definitely more social than her. And I thought of her as an introvert, but when she gets into her element, she's the extrovert.
Yeah, she's.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then, so I was doing all this, some research and then all this kind of event activation, training, companies speaking, going around, doing all that. It was a great business. But then the pandemic came and really just stuff hit the fan. Right? Like I wasn't sure how I was going to support myself. I was still finishing up writing a book.
Was it your first book?
Second. My first book was came out the day Trump was elected. So nothing sold. It's like the books that came out on 9/11, right? Like there are certain dates that everybody knows those books just launched to nothingness. I'm really proud of that book. It was called The 2 a.m. Principle. It was about the science of adventure. Super fun book, but it went nowhere. And then I had to pivot my entire company to teach organizations how to engage and connect at distance. So instead of how to connect at purpose and how do you run a conference online? How do you work with your teams at distance because the mechanics are different? While I was writing a book, I'm really fortunate because the book's topic was connection, trust, and belonging. So it hit the New York Times bestseller list. It became a Wall Street Journal bestseller. It challenged kind of everything that we do in corporate America to build trust with people and showed the science that it works literally the opposite and how it's accomplished.
Awesome. Got it. And so that went really well. And so I guess with this pivot, how quick was it to start like catching up and feeling that feeling of like, oh, I'm going to be okay, because 73%.
It was wild. So after the first couple of months, once I started pivoting, I was like, okay, we're going to be fine. It might not be as high as last year or the year before. And then I think I saw like a 30% increase. And then I started speaking with the book and it was like, holy cow, this is the best thing that's happened to me. We need more pandemics. I'm kidding. We obviously don't. It
is. But I've talked to a lot of people that had similar experiences where it was like, oh God, is the world going to end? And oh my God, this is the best time for my business ever. Like there, other than even restaurants that went delivery saw a cut in costs and a huge spike in revenue. So it was like, you know, it was kind of crazy. Like when you leaned into it, and how did you get through that? Cause like you lose 3/4 of your business. How did you force yourself to lean in and go for it versus like throw in the towel and go do something else? Like, how did you get the mental capacity for it?
The simple answer is that because I've hosted thousands, right? I've hosted 325 dinners. I've probably hosted, I don't know, at this point, let's say at least 3,000 people. At that point, it was probably like 2,500 or whatever it was. And I knew that the answer was in the community of people that I've hosted. That I just need to talk to everybody and be the central hub and resource for them to help them figure stuff out. And something would emerge. Like my general view is that no matter what the problem, the answer is in your community and the people you surround yourselves with. And so I kept having more and more conversations and I'd see certain patterns emerge. And then I sat down with, I have a creative director and I said, hey, I need a sounding board. I need your input on this. What changes when we're going from doing something in person to doing something online, right? So why does watching a football game feel different when we're at the stadium than when we're watching it at home? What is missing? What is different? And what's the opportunity? What did the platform allow that one doesn't and does. And as we broke it down, we began to see certain patterns of human behavior. We began to see that, okay, if we're going to get on Zoom calls, we're suffering from a whole slew of things ranging from perspective fatigue, meaning that we're always seeing the same angle, to, whereas if you watch like a show, they're constantly cutting angles every so often, their beats. So let's use a broadcast software to change angles and use multiple angles when we give talks. Okay, that's interesting. What else do you have? Well, you're giving people a feeling of connection and a feeling of belonging. You don't get that from watching it at home. So that means that if we're doing an online talk or we're bringing together a conference, we need to start using the breakout room so that people can feel like they're important and can be heard and can have a conversation. Even if it's not relevant to the content, it'll prevent them from getting up to go wash dishes. And so we began developing these models that turned out to be really effective. And so we trained some of the biggest companies out there that are running like 50,000 person plus conferences that had to suddenly switch to online on how to do this and how to create multiple tracks and how people bounce from room to room and like all these kinds of different things to prevent burnout. And anyway, you get the idea.
Yep. Yeah. And so as COVID progressed, and I'm not going to say went away, but world opened up, did you just swing back into what you were doing, like business as usual? Like, how did it kind of, how has it come?
No. I rebranded as the trust guy. So like when relationships really matter, that's when people call me. So now I wrote an article that got me a lot of flack. I became like literally public enemy number three on Twitter. And the title of the article was "The Hybrid Workplace Probably Won't Last, and Here's Why." And what I did was I broke down the science of how all the things that actually make work enjoyable have to do with our ability to connect in meaningful ways. And I broke down the science about distance, all these kind of different things about how long people are willing to travel, like all of it. But nobody actually read the article. Everybody just read the title and then cursed at me and deleted my Wikipedia page and all that. And this caused all the news outlets to call me up and ask me to be a talking head. Because when you write something that sounds really extreme and then can back it up with really meaningful insights, then I think you're standing on in a great situation. So I wrote this for the Boston Globe. It was like the number one article for them for like who knows even how long. And that led me to be on all the shows, which also led the book to hit the New York Times bestseller list. And not only taught me a great lesson, but because my arguments were really sound, I basically said, listen, the fact is that if you don't care about the people that you're working with, you're just going to go work somewhere else soon after. Right? Whoever's offering you a few more dollars to sit on Zoom, you'll take the money.
Yep. So, every business owner is saying that right now. Everyone, every single CEO, which I talk to a lot of them, is saying the exact same thing. Like, it's just a mercenary group at this point, unless you build relationships. And getting back in office for that, it's not a micromanagement perspective, it's a relationship perspective.
So I would argue that it's both. It's
for some people.
Yes. The fact is that managing people was never a great way to do anything, unless you are in the military or you're in like a plantation, right? When people don't, when you're forcing labor because it's slavery, yes, you have to manage people. What you actually want to do is manage outcomes, and that you can do at a distance or in person. So what we actually need is to retrain leaders to manage outcomes, which is a complex, very different strategy. And then the second aspect is that if you want people to actually enjoy their experience at work, it needs a human aspect, because what allows us to not freak out, not have anxiety, not have depression is the human aspect. Those coffee breaks or those water cooler conversations reduce your cortisol levels. They allow you to calm down. When you are super stressed, it's nurturing social ties that actually let you get through it. And we've all had that experience. Like, I'm freaking out because something terrible happens. I have that friend I call and then I feel much better after. Or I talk to my wife. And I
think we could go down the rabbit hole here, but how do you educate a workforce? You said you became public enemy number three. How do you educate a workforce that they're actually better off doing that when they're probably associating the anxiety that they're feeling with the idea of commuting, of having to come in, of being managed, of all these things? How do you get that buy-in versus get your Wikipedia page deleted?
The first is that we have to admit something that sounds ridiculous. A company's office policy is most likely set by measuring the CEO's distance from their favorite home to the office. If their favorite home is in Jackson Hole, then you know it's a remote culture. If their favorite home is a few blocks from the office, they want people in, right? So that's like, I joke, but it's probably very true.
No, there's studies about that, that most, the highest correlation where the office is where the CEO lives. It's a thing.
So then the second thing we need to understand is that when it comes to trust and communication, we want to understand the substance of trust. Trust is made of three things. It's made of honesty, you're telling the truth, competence, you can do the work that's expected of you. And the third is that you're benevolent, you have other people's best interests at heart. Okay? They're not equally valued. If one of your employees messes up one day after doing a generally great job, you go, oh, they had a bad day. You don't say they're incompetent, I can't trust them. If you found out somebody was lying to you, you'd begin to doubt everything they say though. So yep. Honesty valued more than competence. But two of us are walking down the street. You say, John, can we stop by Craig's house? I need to pick something up. And when I get there, 40 of my closest friends jump out and scream, surprise, happy birthday. It would be strange if I said, Eric, you lied to me. We can't be friends anymore. Right? Like, that just sounds crazy.
Right.
And that's because it was benevolent. We value benevolence over honesty and honesty over competence.
Got it.
In every communication you hear from CEOs, they talk about competence. They say, we are more productive in the office. You need to come back. My attitude is, you got to lead with benevolence. I like having you as part of the team. I don't want to lose you. We do not have all the answers on how to make hybrid work be really great yet. So we need time together. It's the only thing we know that reduces people's stress significantly, reduces their anxiety, causes us to feel connected, and measurably increases our satisfaction in life that we have control over. We want you to stick around. And if we don't do this, you're going to be burnt out and you're going to leave anyway. So yep. I know this might not be the most convenient thing, but it's the only solution we know right now.
Yep.
And so we want you back.
Yep.
And communicating that versus you're more productive in the office. Productivity is a completely arbitrary measure. Like, we do not know a great way to measure productivity.
Yeah.
I mean, you can measure it if you're like talking about cars produced on an assembly line or something, but knowledge workers, it's very different. You don't measure ideas.
Yeah, totally fair. So you've come back to this, you're the trust guy after becoming public enemy number three. It seems like a lot of people also have listened to you. What's next? What do you think's next for you? What does the future look
like? So as this all came together, a few things became really clear. Number one was that everything we kind of do to build trust and connection and belonging, we do wrong or backwards. And the basic unit of productivity is not an individual, but the more time we spend at home alone, we think that everything revolves around us. The basic unit of productivity is, or effectiveness, is a team. And what I began to realize is that we severely overvalue the leader and severely undervalue the team. And there's all these major problems. One that I think you'll get a kick out of because you are an investor in a sports team. There's this funny thing in soccer, European football, called the too much talent problem. Researchers looked at the performance of teams at the World Cup and found that when the team surpassed 60% superstars, the team produced a total fewer goals.
Huh.
And the argument was that at a certain point, the large personalities overwhelm the team dynamics, right? Everybody wants to be the one to cause the thing, to be the one kicking the ball.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, here's what's interesting. Having more superstars is important. It's table stakes at a certain point. But it really only matters the smaller the team is and dependent on the sport you're playing. If you are playing tennis singles, being Serena Williams, you dominate for 25 years.
Right.
Single superstar.
Yeah.
When you get to the complexity of a football team or soccer team, it really breaks down.
Yeah.
But in baseball, this phenomenon doesn't happen. And that's because baseball is an individual sport played as a team. The players really have very little coordination with each other.
Yeah.
You know, the catcher isn't trying to outdo the people in the outfield to catch them, right? Like, it's just not. Yeah. So team dynamics matter a lot less. You can moneyball that sport a lot more.
Yeah.
And so I became very curious what actually makes the team operate. And it turns out that you need, and we can go into this in another time, but like certain types of personalities that actually cause the team to come together. And then what actually matters with the leader is really none of the stuff we look at, like none of them.
Which always gets the credit too, which I think is probably another thing.
Yeah, yeah, which is really interesting, right?
Yeah, 100%. So last question for you. With all these people you've talked to and all these people you've met, these they're the top achievers in every one of their fields, which is what this podcast is all about. What is one commonality you think that allows people? And usually I ask, what's the one thing that you've heard or you would recommend? But I would say, like, from what you've observed, what's the one commonality between people that are high achievers in all these different fields or all these award winners, all these, you know, Nobel laureates, these Academy
Awards? I'll put in two things, if that's okay.
Please.
Number one is that they're incredibly not well-rounded. This idea that you have to have all these skills to succeed is a pile of total crap, frankly.
Yep.
They are so overwhelmingly good at one or two things that people are willing to trust them to shine in those ways.
Yep.
Right. Let's take somebody I've never hosted, like an Elon Musk. He is terrible at every metric of a leader, except I'd say two things. One is, he thinks better at scale than anyone in our culture. And he acts faster. I mean, literally, if you ever read articles about how SpaceX moved from day to day, like that guy plows through problems, right? Everything else is a train wreck. But he has hired great people around him. So the first and foremost thing is that these people have one or two, maybe three skills that are just incredible. And the rest of it is not great. They can maybe think in n dimensions, but don't really know how to hold a great conversation, right? Like they're, you know, exactly kind of what you'd expect. The second thing that's really important to understand about all these people is that no matter how successful somebody is, there's still an element that they feel like they don't fit in. So the Nobel laureate knows that it was a lucky day in a lab or that they got the right doctoral thesis advisor. The CEO knows they've had a couple of good quarters, but if the next two are bad, they're out of a job and they're not making significant pay.
Yeah.
The advertising exec knows that they had some great campaigns, but if they don't get another big hit soon, they're going to not win at Cannes Lion or whatever it is, right? Yeah. There's the Olympian won by 1/100th of a second in the swimming, whatever competition. But at the next one, they might not even qualify. So everybody feels like, hey, I've got some success. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, there are no guarantees on tomorrow.
Love that. Got it. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on.
Oh, this has been a pleasure, Eric. You know, anytime you want to hang out and chat, this is my joy.
Me too. We'll be doing it soon. Thank you again, sir.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Hawk Talk. To ensure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, we'd love for you to give us a quick rating for the show. Just tap the number of stars you think this podcast deserves. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.